Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember the other day we were talking about this Kuma Tire story, where an administrative law judge in the Trump administration said that the company had violated federal law by telling the workforce, if you have the audacity to join a union, we'll move this place and you'll be penniless. And, you know, all of the kind of intimidation that we've known over the years has happened. You now have an administrative law judge saying this happened. And as I said the other day, the fact that there'll be a revote is not a punishment. Because in the back of everyone's mind is still, you know, they threatened it before. To me, there has to be really harsh penalties when people break the law like this. You steal three peppermint patties in Philadelphia, you spend 500 days in jail. I got to tell you, I think this rises to a much higher level than a couple of peppermint patties. And here to share some thoughts on the Kuma Tire story, I've asked Maria Soma to come talk with us. She's organizing director with the United Steelworkers Union. Maria, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick. I'm really glad you're covering this story. I just want to add one comment, and that is that the federal government, through the administrative law judge, didn't find that they violated the law a few times. They found that they violated the law over 25 times. So this was an egregious employer who broke the law over and over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, that just makes it worse. I mean, even if they just do it once, to me, that you sow that kernel of thought into people's mind, that there's a chilling effect that goes with that.
Absolutely. If you don't mind, I'd like to give just a few brief facts that will kind of put this into perspective. The first fact is that this is a foreign-owned tire company that received millions of dollars to come into the state of Georgia and to do economic development. They promised employees there a certain percentage of wages and that they would have good working and safe working conditions. In fact, the workers who started there, who are predominantly African American, who live in that community, a fairly, I won't say depressed, but economic conditions there are ripe for a foreign national company to come in and take advantage of the workforce. And that's exactly what they did here. So this company came in, made certain promises that they broke. The workers then decided to take matters into their own hands, legally, which is to try to form a union. They did so, and they signed union authorization cards with United Steelworkers. 80% of them signed those cards. We went into that workplace with 80% of the workers saying they wanted a union there. Then a period of 3 weeks to a month, this employer bombarded them with anti-union information, literature, threats, harassment, meetings, every day for a three-week period. And that turned a large percentage of the voting population into terror. They terrorized them. I call it psychological warfare. It's exactly what happened there. Now picture, you go into work. You're ready there to work your 8-12-hour shift. And instead of actually being able to work, management requires you to go to these what we call captive audience meetings, which are mandatory meetings every day, every shift for 1 to 2 hours. You are required to sit there while they berate the union and make these threats. That's the first thing that happened. Then they have union busters. We found that Kuma spent probably over $500,000 in a three-week period on outside agitators, union busters, who came in and then met with these workers individually. So they had to meet with union busters on top of the 1 to 2 hours they had to go in a captive audience meeting on every shift for a three-week period. They met the union busters, and then their lead supervisors required them to meet with them. So you go in for your shift, and you spend hours every day being bombarded and berated by the employees about that if a union comes in, they'll threaten to close the plant. They make all of these threats. So that's the situation that happened at Kumo. It truly was psychological warfare to a population that was extremely vulnerable with a company that came in and received millions of dollars in taxpayer money incentives to be there.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you lay this out, and really the penalty, the punishment of a revote is nothing at all. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, as you're going through all this and all of that harassment and all of that intimidation, for me, that would have hardened my belief that, holy, we need something and we need badly. You know, I go back to something my grandfather always said. He said, you know, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, or in this case, $500,000, you better spend two to get it. And this, because look, they don't have your interest at heart. They've got their own.
Right. That's exactly right. And right now, the remedy, you're right, the remedy is really mild that the law has. And that remedy is what the administrative law judge only ordered was that the, which this is big, the CEO has to read the complaints that the NLRB, the complaints from the NLRB. They had to read that at a mandatory meeting. They had to send that information out of how they broke the law to all the employees. And then the only other thing they ordered was a rerun election, where once again, this company will have the right to do it all over again.
Right. And hire the same union busters to come in, and the same intimidation, the same harassment. And this is where, again, I go back through this, you know, this moment where we've got to revisit the National Labor Relations Act. And I say we need to go back to the original intent of the act, which didn't have periods like this. You signed the cards, you recognized a bargaining representative, and you began bargaining for a contract. There was no, we're going to harass and intimidate. There was none of that stuff, which is why we saw an explosion of organizing happen, you know, post-NLRA. To me, that's the first part. You know, get rid of that, get rid of Taft-Hartley, and go back to the original intent of the Wagner Act.
Well, I wish that we could do that, and I wish it was so easy to do that. However, you know, we've got this law fully ensconced. There is a new act that has just been introduced called the Protect Workers' Rights to Organize Act, right, shortened for PRO Act, and that's to try to take on some of these holes, these loopholes that exist in the labor law today. So mandatory meetings like the ones that the CUMA workers had to endure will no longer be able to be required of employees. Stricter and harsher outcomes or penalties, excuse me, for employers if they do egregious breaking of the law. There's lots of things that are in the PRO Act that would help try to fix some of these loopholes.
That's a start. No, and look, you chuckle at me saying that I would like to see us return to saner days. And this is where this is how, you know, as a union organizer, you understand the idea of you push for what you want. And then maybe you settle for something a little bit less than that. And I look at, you know, something like the Employee Free Choice Act, which I thought was a settle. We didn't even get that.
To
me, you know, this is one of these moments where workers have been suffering and struggling, and you know, we now see wages have been stagnant. The big tax heist didn't help. Families are struggling. Healthcare is getting out of control. You know, pensions have been eviscerated, and it's most working people are looking around going, "Help! What do we do?" And what we do is we get them the ability to organize free of this kind of harassment. Because you ask anybody, yeah, I'd join a union tomorrow, but I don't want to go through that.
That's exactly right. You are absolutely right.
So to me, it's, you know, push the goalpost. And at this moment, while people are energized and active and angry, use that. Because this isn't, you know, and the reason I wanted to talk about this story is this isn't unusual. This isn't unique. This is what corporate America has been getting away with for decades now.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. We have to sit there and fight back. But to me, the fight back is with the workers. And so as an organizer, right, I wish the law would change, and we'll fight for that every step of the way. We need to have ways in which to protect the workers. But this is all about figuring out how to tap into people's fears or tap into people's anger that exists right now and saying, don't let the boss control every aspect of your life.
Yep.
And so how do we do that? We do that by really educating and working with members to take control of their workplaces and then say, you have the legal right to do that. And the job of the union is to make sure we're working with you to protect your legal right to form that union in your workplace. But you got to be strong enough which to take on the boss right now because the law isn't there. And until that law changes, right, all of this lies in the hands of workers who want change enough to take the action that's needed to do it.
And I would argue not just even only the workers in the shop, but the community as well. I mean, this is
absolutely,
these are the kind of moments where you need to rediscover the concept of solidarity, class solidarity, where you go, look, you know, the old Knights of Labor, an injury to all being injury to one being an injury to all. If their working conditions are deplorable and unsafe, guess what your working conditions are eventually going to be. And understanding that if we allow one bad actor to get away with this stuff, that you've got a whole bunch of bad actors. So let me ask you on this side, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, has come up in my mind is, okay, they slapped him on the wrist, a little tap on the wrist, you got to revote. You know, who's to say that they don't close down in a year and say, well, you voted for a union, we're out the door. There's really nothing the law is going to do to protect them, is there?
That's absolutely correct. Now, here's the thing. They can't close because they went union, but they can close for any other reason. You're right. The law doesn't protect that. However, in a case like Kumho, where they have millions of taxpayer investment in that plant, in that facility, where they're also investing in new technology, that plant is only a few years old and has millions and millions and millions of dollars invested in it. I can't imagine a company saying they're going to go ahead and close after that amount of investment.
So,
nor should the state permit that, because the state invested in that company by giving it that tax. Those
right.
Tax breaks and the tax incentive.
No, because the reason I ask this, because that kernel is still in the back of people's minds.
I mean, you go
back to that vote in 2017, and I have to imagine that was the reason people go, it's a bad job, but at least I have a job. And we've heard that a million times.
That's exactly correct.
So, you know, I want to address that issue, because I got to imagine it's still in the back of folks' minds.
It is. And so what is good about at least having the CEO come in and read this is to say that they can't make those threats. That when they made those threats, it was not based on fact. And if you read the decision of the ALJ, that's exactly what they found, was that they made these threats not based on any actual evidence that they provided. So you're right. We can't prevent a company from closing if they're doing poor economically, or if the owner decides that they're going to shut down and move business somewhere else. We can't prevent that with the law. But in this particular case, the threat of it was not based on any facts. They were just making them as a threat, and that in itself is illegal.
No, it's just a matter of, we're making so much money, we want to keep it for ourselves.
Right. That's exactly what happened here. Right?
And
so you've got to also understand, right, so that they are saying that they were going to, how they're contributing to the community is providing these jobs in which the community then can use their wages to spend within, you know, where they live, et cetera, increase the tax base, et cetera. But that wasn't happening. They were not paying the money that they had originally promised the state they would when they moved there, and the workers when they first hired them.
Yeah, and I had also read something about, you know, working conditions. I mean, a lot of people think organizing is all about, you know, about wages and benefits.
Right.
Most of the time when I talk to people who have organized new unions, it's about unsafe working conditions and it's about poor treatment. And it sounds to me like this is a place that, you know, outside of the poor treatment of being beaten verbally, you know, for months while this union busting was going on, I also understand that the conditions aren't great either.
No, and if you read, they were just actually fined by OSHA, and they're in the midst of trying to negotiate the penalties right now. But OSHA just found, and I can't remember the amount that they fined them or the act, the violations, but they were found to have some severe health and safety violations. And OSHA has done some major fines against the company right now. So Kumho has not reacted or responded to those fines or to OSHA's findings at the moment that I'm aware of.
Wow.
So what it proves is you've got a very new plant that should be safe with new technology in it. And instead, what the company has done is provided an unsafe environment, and unsafe enough that OSHA had to come in. And after they did their investigation to really find them several violations of OSHA and find them by the tens of thousands of dollars.
So how does the union help? How does the union fix that? How does the union help with that? I mean, because I know that's a question that's got to come up, going, well, you know what? The union really can't do anything.
Weak.
What's the response to it?
our response is absolutely that, especially in the tire making, we represent a majority of the tire makers in this country. We have health and safety department that deals directly with tire facilities and tire members who are trained around safety regulations that should be put there. The employer is going to go, any employer is going to try to be as cheap as they can around health and safety issues.
Sure.
Our union has a health and safety department and a health and safety conference that we have every other year where we have 1,000 members and employers who come to learn about different systems that can be put in place to protect workers better. And so we believe that our union, specifically the steelworkers, has a track record and a history of providing a much safer workplace than the non-union facilities. Now, our tire makers have, we have a whole council of different employers that spend a lot of time just on health and safety regulations and dealing with specific to the chemicals around the tire and the machines that are there to make tire. Tire building is a very tough job, and that involves a lot of chemicals. And people don't think about the chemical components of making a tire. And we have experts in our health and safety department who do nothing but deal with tire plants.
No, you guys do incredible work. And this is where I want to kind of finish this up, because one of the things that unions do, and the steel workers do it as well as anyone, is, you know, they partner with employers to figure out, hey, how can we both do better? And this is one of these things where I keep saying, you know, the employer being so anti-union, it's kind of short-sighted, because the union does an awful lot of work to try and help save them injuries, save them costs, save them money, and streamlining and making things safer and more efficient. And it's always been curious to me why you don't have more employers going, you know what, I do want to partner with my workforce. I do want to tap into the expertise that you've laid out.
Yes, and absolutely correct. And we have several of our unionized tire partner companies who partner with us on a regular basis. And again, I mentioned our health and safety conference that we have every 16 months out of the year, every 16 months. And there we have a joint employer and employee union sessions where we come together to have those very discussions by employer and by sectors to figure out how we work well, better together, to figure out how we can put systems in place to protect workers. And yes, we do this all the time in our unionized workshops. We know we can't provide a safer workplace without the employer being on board. Now, most of the time, we try to, you know, make sure that it's that we invite them and that we're partnering with them. But if there are times and they're not willing to partner, then we got to do what we got to do to protect our members.
And we
do that on a daily basis also.
No, I mean, for me, it's incredible to me that any working person in this country doesn't belong to a union, doesn't have a contract, because I've been asking, you know, how many CEOs out there don't have contracts? Sure. They want them. They just don't want you to have them. That's mind-blowing to me. But, Maria, I appreciate the time. I wish you guys the best of luck in going forward, and I'd love to have you back as this continues down the road.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Appreciate it. Maria Soma, organizing director there at the U.S. Steelworkers. I mean, this is one of those moments where, you know, the Trump administrative law judge is the one who said they violated the law. And as she pointed out, egregious amounts of violations. Insane. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.